From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. A day after President Trump abruptly called off coronavirus relief talks, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows is sending mixed signals about reaching an agreement with White House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to help people struggling financially during this pandemic. Meadows spoke with Fox and Friends this morning.
We're still willing to be engaged, but I'm not optimistic for a comprehensive deal. I am optimistic that there's about 10 things that we could do on a piecemeal basis if the speaker is willing to put it before her members.
Let's bring in Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional correspondent, for more on this. And Kelsey, what's going on? The White House has sent so many mixed messages on the relief bill over the last 24 hours. What do they really want here?
You know, that's a good question. The president has said he wanted a stimulus bill on Saturday. Then he said yesterday the talks were over. And then a few hours later, late at night, he started demanding standalone bills. The responses are erratic and kind of disconnected with the entire process of negotiation so far. You know, his representatives have been talking about standalone bills like the Chief of Staff Meadows mentioned in that clip. They've been talking about that since at least July. And since at least that time, Democrats have rejected it, saying that they can't agree to address one part of the pandemic crisis while ignoring the rest. They say that they don't trust the White House to remain consistent in the negotiations, and they don't think the president will agree to additional bills if Democrats decide to back the few elements that he's willing to sign today. You know, the only outlier so far has been money for the airlines, which House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said the House will pass as a standalone or in a bigger bill. Plus, Democrats are pointing to advice from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, who says more stimulus is needed and urgently to avoid layoffs, business bankruptcies, and, you know, an economic slowdown.
Okay. So Speaker Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin actually spoke this morning. Mm-hmm. What did they talk about?
You know, we don't know the entirety of their conversation, but one of Pelosi's aides says the Treasury Secretary brought up the possibility of that standalone airline bill. You know, Pelosi told him that the House Republicans already blocked that bill last week and asked him to go back and familiarize himself with the legislation.
Okay. What else might get done? President Trump wants another round of $1,200 checks sent out to most Americans. And of course, the election we're in the midst of the election now, but officially it's 1 month away.
Well, you know, I think it's notable that Pelosi did not exactly reject the idea of the airline bill. That still seems pretty open. But, you know, there has been disagreement about those checks that you mentioned and a number of elements in this bill. I think it's important to remember that not a single element of coronavirus relief discussed in the past 24 hours is exactly new. These talks have been happening for months with very little progress. Mm-hmm. Republicans have been saying they won't sign off on more spending. Democrats say they won't sign off on less. And the president was really absent until this week. So this is a pretty chaotic moment. You know, the headlines all day yesterday were about the president ending talks. And Democrats say they're confident that's what voters will see, what they'll hear and what they'll believe. You know, to give you a sense of the acrimony today, Pelosi just told reporters on Capitol Hill that the president wants checks with his name on them, and Congress needs to do more than that to help people and get the virus under control.
Okay, so the two sides remain roughly $1 trillion apart. Oh, my goodness, what a number. And Meadows said that the Democratic proposal includes bailouts for blue states. What specifically was he referring to?
He's talking about money for state and local governments that say they're running out of money. Some states have already begun laying off employees because, you know, states cannot run deficits. And governors have been warning for months that they're in dire straits. It's not just Democratic governors, but this is, I think, one of those arguments where the president is speaking mostly about the blue states that have needed the money.
Yeah. With the 30 seconds I have for you, you know, one thing that the president has done by blowing up talks is he's changed the news cycle by not talking about his health. What is the latest on his health?
You know, we know we're following updates very closely, as doctors have said that in the next few days are going to be critical to see how he's responding to these coronavirus treatments. Yesterday, his doctors gave a brief update saying that he's doing well.
That's Kelsey Snell. She's NPR's congressional correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tonight, the vice presidential candidates, Mike Pence and Kamala Harris, will participate in their first and only debate. And joining us now is the guy who debated Pence last time around in 2016, Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia. Senator, welcome back.
Jeremy, good to be with you guys. Thanks.
Well, and first of all, given the fact that the president of the United States has COVID-19 and he has been in somewhat close contact, at least over the last week, with the vice president, should this debate even be taking place tonight?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, I know I saw that Dr. Redfield, the head of the CDC, said the contact was not so close that it should prohibit the debate from going forward. I know that Kamala Harris is raring to go, so but it does seem like all these rules are being upended. I am at least glad that the debate organizers are installing plexiglass shields and moving Kamala and the vice president farther apart so they don't pose any danger to each other or anybody else.
You were the last person to debate Vice President Pence in a forum like this. What does Senator Harris need to do tonight, do you think?
You know, it's she's going to do fine. I mean, as we know, working with Senator Harris in the Senate, she does very, very well in these settings. But Mike Pence is a great debater. Remember, he was a radio talk show guy before he was in politics. So he can look in a camera and deliver a line, you know, even if it's not necessarily a truthful one, but he can do it with a great deal of sincerity. I would say this, a key feature of tonight's debate that was different than 2016 was in 2016, neither party was the incumbent. So Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were each making their case, and their vice presidential nominees were too, about here's what we'll do if we're in office. This debate, there's an incumbent administration. The Trump-Pence administration has had 4 years, and so Kamala Harris, the prosecutor, has a lot of evidence. It's not just about what you're going to do. Well, let's look at what you've done. We have deaths at an unprecedented scale because of coronavirus. We've lost 10 million jobs since March. There's social division unlike any time since the 1960s. Do you want 4 more years of that, or would you like to return to, you know, competence and character and compassion? So I think she needs to marshal the evidence, and she's got plenty of it, and she's used to doing that as a longtime, you know, prosecutor and effective senator in these committee hearings, as we've seen her.
This is not the only big news happening today, so let me just ask you about a couple of other things. We got that series of tweets from President Trump yesterday saying that he doesn't want to do any more negotiations on more relief, economic relief for people affected by the pandemic until after the election. What do you think about that? Do you have any hope after that series of tweets that Congress and the president can reach a deal on COVID-19 relief before the election?
President Trump killed that yesterday. He did that announcement right when the Speaker Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin were scheduled to talk to try to further narrow down differences. And we were hopeful we would get there. Remember, we had the experience in March in the Senate of the Republicans offering a partisan proposal on a Sunday that we voted down. But once we voted that down, that then led to significant discussions, and we got a deal that was good for American people, small businesses, hospitals, states. Why the president would come out of the hospital and just suddenly decide he wanted to terminate negotiations the same day that the Fed chief, Jay Powell, was saying, you've got to do another bill and it should be bigger, not smaller. We're still trying to figure out why the president cut off all discussions.
Well, so do you think, though, that since he did that, that in fact there wouldn't be able to be a COVID relief bill until after the inauguration, because if you're in a lame duck session and the president is reelected, you're still going to have a divided Congress until January. And if the president is not reelected and Joe Biden becomes the president, he's not going to take office till January. So does this mean we have to wait now until January for any kind of economic relief coming from Washington?
Jeremy, here's my sense. The American public overwhelmingly want us to do another COVID bill. They want us to wait till after the election on the Supreme Court, but they want us to do a COVID bill right now. If President Trump is reelected, he'll want another bill for his own sake. If Joe Biden is elected, I don't think the Senate GOP is going to be thinking that much about President Trump. They're going to be thinking about their own elections in 2022 and 2024, and they're going to be listening to the citizens. I think the odds are high we'll be getting a COVID bill in November or December. It's just a shame that we've had to wait. Remember, the House passed the fifth bill, the HEROES Act, in May. Why mm-hmm. we would have to wait for 6 months to do it is beyond me.
And what about the Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett? You're not on the Judiciary Committee, but do you think Republicans are going to be able to get her onto the Supreme Court before the election?
If they want to break the promise that they made to us and the American public that in a presidential election year, you should wait till after the election and let the people decide, they can do that, Jeremy.
They seem to be saying that they do want to break that promise.
Yes. If they are really, you know, just we've got to do this. And actually, it's not the election day that's the key. What's the key is November 10th, the day that the Supreme Court takes up the Affordable Care Act case. They're rushing this nomination because they want to ensure that they can kill the Affordable Care Act and take health insurance away from millions and millions. This is what they've tried to do since the first day President Trump was in office. So if they are just absolutely dedicated to having her in the seat on November 10th to kill the Affordable Care Act, they can do it. However, there's always a chance that something during the Judiciary Committee hearings could cause someone to rethink, do we really need to rush this? I think it's unlikely, but it's not a zero chance. And so I know my Judiciary Committee colleagues are working real hard to illuminate the kinds of things that would make other senators and the American public wary about rushing.
That is Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat of Virginia, and the last person to debate Vice President Mike Pence in the vice presidential debate. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Jeremy, good to be back. Thanks.
And tonight's debate starts at 9 p.m. Eastern time. It is going to be unlike any we've seen, in part because there will be plexiglass separating the candidates. The pandemic has taken a toll on economies around the world. Millions of jobs lost, businesses closed, the future in doubt. We want to check in now on how three countries in Asia are doing. Joining us now is NPR's Emily Feng in China's Qinghai province, NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, South Korea, and the BBC's Arunadeh Mukherjee in Delhi in India. Welcome to all of you. And Emily, let me start with you because China is where the coronavirus originated, as far as we know. Chinese officials say the economy is now in recovery mode. Tell us what it is like there at this point.
Well, right now we're in the middle of a big national holiday. It's essentially China's July 4th, and it's always been a big travel week. This year, travel agencies and the tourism authorities predict that people will take between 550 to 600 million trips this week alone within China, which sounds like a huge number, and it is, but that's about 30% lower than the number last year. That being said, people really feel like things have returned to normal, though many still voluntarily wear masks. I personally have been traveling for work and pleasure in the last 2 weeks, and I've been to tourist sites where streets are so packed you can't move, but you just have to drift with the crowd. I've gone to an electronic music dance rave for work, where people moshed in the thousands. So there is a sense of normalcy now.
And what about the economy there in China? It may be normal in terms of travel within China, but it's very difficult still for people from the outside to come in.
Yes. Well, China looks like it might be the only major economy this year to post positive economic growth. Economists predict now that that might be just around 2% of growth this year. There has been some revenge spending. So, for example, sales of luxury items have skyrocketed here in the last quarter, but consumption is what's been really lagging. It's not recovered as fast as, say, manufacturing or heavy industry, and that's because people on the lowest economic rungs of Chinese society, these temporary migrant workers, people who originate from rural areas, they're really suffering financially and they're still spending less.
And do you ever hear about a case of COVID-19 popping up somewhere in China at this point?
Yes, there were about 20 new cases this week so far, but they're all from people coming in from other countries and entering China.
Hmm. Anthony Kuhn, to you in Seoul, South Korea, it never imposed the sort of nationwide lockdown that has really hurt economies in other countries. But how would you describe the situation at this point where you are?
Well, they've definitely taken an economic hit from the pandemic, but it's a lot less serious than if they hadn't been well prepared for this. They had a plan, which was to do aggressive testing and contact tracing. And because they knew who was infected and where they were able to keep those people separate. Fewer people were infected, and so factories stayed open in general. Millions of people traveled for the recent mid-autumn festival, even though the government suggests they didn't. And as a result, their GDP is probably going to contract about 1% this year, which is better than almost any other developed economy. Compare it to, for example, 5.8% contraction for Japan, 10.5% for Italy. And by one estimate I've seen, it probably would have cost them about twice as much if they had locked down, but they didn't.
And we heard Emily say that some people are voluntarily wearing masks in China. What is life like in South Korea at this point?
Well, it's been, you know, masks here all the time. But people, like elsewhere, people are fatigued. Not everybody is following orders to stay put. and they're just battling down their second wave of infections. So they're doing very well compared to other countries, but it's still difficult.
Let's turn to Delhi and the BBC's Arunaday Mukherjee. Arunaday, India is one of the countries that is having the hardest time right now in terms of new cases of COVID-19, in terms of deaths. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, the total number of coronavirus cases in India are now over 6.7 million. The death toll, too, has crossed 100,000. India recording over 70,000 cases in the last 24 hours and nearly 1,000 deaths. The last 1 million cases, in fact, came in a mere 11 days. India is, in fact, very close to overtaking the U.S. and becoming the country with the highest number of COVID-19 cases. And what is even more alarming is that India is entering what is traditionally called the festive season here in October. So there is a huge chance of cases spiking because of more congregations at religious, cultural and social gatherings. And the government has just recently, on the 1st of October, eased restrictions on public gatherings. So that is a point of concern. And the government making it very clear that they have to revive the economy despite these figures. And that's why you're seeing restrictions consistently being eased.
And give us a sense of what that means at this point in Delhi. Is everyone wearing a mask? Is there any social distancing at all?
It's very difficult to maintain that, especially because the government has been easing those lockdown restrictions, and there is a sense of lockdown fatigue. Of course, it wasn't the case when India saw the massive 2.5 month lockdown when people were taking it seriously. But now, when India is seeing over 70,000 cases every day, it's ironic that that kind of seriousness is not there. And it is, and the economy is really bearing the biggest brunt. India's economy contracting by 23.9%, the worst since 1996, and one of the worst among G20 nations. It is being seen as a historic low, and the rising number of cases mean the outlook for the rest of the year is also very grim. And what's important to understand is that the Indian economy was in any case growing at its slowest in the last 6 years, and COVID-19 just came and dealt a body blow to any scope of recovery.
Arunaday, are people in India, is there a movement in India that's saying we've got to tighten the restrictions, there's only one way out of this, and that is going to be to really be very restrictive about social distancing, about mask wearing, and let's get this under control? Does that exist?
Well, we're seeing a lot of demands for that coming in from academics from several quarters. But unfortunately, the challenge that we're seeing here is in implementation. We've seen the government come out and issue instructions, week after week, coming out and saying that people must adhere to all the government notifications, wear masks, practice social distancing. But many experts point out that there is a huge gap between what the government is saying and what really is percolating down on the ground. And there is a conflict in messaging, say many experts, because while you're talking about social distancing, while you're talking about the seriousness of the disease spreading at an alarming rate in India, unfortunately, you're also opening up sectors. Just recently, India has now opened up multiplexes, albeit at 50% capacity. But what is the message that is really going out to the citizens is in many pockets that, look, things are actually improving, whereas they're certainly not.
You know, it's kind of stunning to hear what's going on there and then look at what's happening here, where the president of the United States is now infected with coronavirus, as are a number of people in his inner circle. We're seeing, you know, close to 50,000 cases a day and sometimes 1,000 deaths a day. Emily, what's the view of what's happening in the United States from China?
When Chinese people and Chinese leaders look at what's happening in the U.S., it further strengthens their conviction that their what were seen as draconian policies at the time, to lock down entire cities, to put people into months-long home isolation, that those were the right things to do. People feel increasingly satisfied with how their national leaders have behaved in comparison to how other countries have handled the coronavirus. And so it's bolstered credibility in China.
Mm-hmm. And what about from your perspective in India, Arunaday?
It's interesting because the Indian government obviously has been tracking developments very closely, considering the elections, and also, of course, with Kamala Harris being in the fray, it has invited a lot of interest and curiosity here in the country, with many expecting that, or rather wondering whether someone of Indian origin will actually enter the White House after the results of the elections. Prime Minister Modi recently conveyed his thoughts to President Trump when he announced on social media that he had been invested infected by coronavirus. But in terms of having a conversation about how both countries are doing, I think India and the U.S. have a lot in common in the way in which both have handled, or many say mishandled, the pandemic. Both countries are seeing huge spikes in numbers. India, in fact, could very well very soon overtake the U.S. in just a matter of weeks, going by the numbers we've seen, and claim the spot of the number one country with the maximum number of COVID-19 cases in the world.
And Anthony, what about you? What's the view from Seoul of what's happening in the U.S.?
I think people are shocked. You know, South Korea is a major ally of the U.S. The U.S. is its security guarantor. And this pandemic happens at a time when the alliance is under stress from the Trump administration, which feels that South Korea is not paying enough of defense costs. And so I think the net effect is that it increases the feeling that, you know, South Korea is going to have to stand on its own. And in a way, that makes it feel, I guess, that, you know, the relationship has become more equal in a way.
I'll just finally ask you, Anthony, because you're in South Korea, but it borders North Korea. Do we have any sense at all at this point of what the coronavirus situation is in the borders of very secretive North Korea?
Well, North Korea's ruling Workers' Party recently held a meeting on this, and they said they're not doing as well as they should be, and yet they do not admit to having a single case. The World Health Organization says they have tested thousands of people, and all of them have come up negative. And that really goes against what people know about North Korea's track record when they say they have avoided previous epidemics, when in fact they have had massive infections and a very rickety healthcare system, which is in no shape to handle it.
That is NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, South Korea. We've also been speaking with NPR's Emily Feng in Qinghai province in China and the BBC's Arunade Mukherjee in Delhi, India. Very interesting to hear about how things are going there in Asia. Thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, two women, Emmanuelle Charpentier of France and American Jennifer Doudna, won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for developing a genome editing tool known as CRISPR-Cas9. This is the first time a science Nobel Prize has been awarded to two women, and one of them, Professor Doudna, joins us now. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
Well, and how does it feel to have won this prize?
Well, overwhelming is probably the first word that comes to mind. It's quite stunning and just extraordinary. I'm thinking very much about my collaborator, Emmanuelle Charpentier, students and postdoc who did the work, Martin Yannick in my lab and Chris Chylinski in Emmanuelle's group. So we're very proud of them and just the opportunity to share in the joy about the discovery of CRISPR as a genome editing technology.
Well, and CRISPR is something we've heard so much about in the last many years, but just give our listeners a sense of some of the most important accomplishments that have happened because of the development of CRISPR technology.
Well, I think it's important to mention that this is a technology that comes from a bacterial immune system that gives bacteria the ability to defend themselves against viruses, something that seems particularly relevant maybe now during this pandemic. And over the last 8 years, it's been already applied in medicine and increasingly in agriculture and other areas of biology. And I would just point to recent announcements over the last year about the use of CRISPR in folks that are affected by sickle cell disease as well as cancer. And we're seeing early signs, at least, that, you know, CRISPR is going to be a technology that will probably be, you know, broadly applicable for treating genetic disease in the future as a way to correct the actual genes that lead to disease. And that's I think, what has really attracted a lot of attention, although there's equal opportunities, I would argue, in agriculture as well.
As you know, there have been some ethical concerns about the ways in which CRISPR is used. For example, 2 years ago, a Chinese scientist made public that he had used the tool to edit the genes of two babies to make them resistant to HIV. How do you make sure that this technology is used responsibly?
Hard question, but very, very important. I think the first step has to be the scientific community coming together to address these kinds of questions openly and transparently. And I've been very pleased over the last 5 years that this has really happened more and more. In fact, just very recently in the last few weeks, we've seen release of a report from the National Academies and the Royal Society that collaborated to put out the results of a study by an international commission making recommendations about how the scientific and clinical communities can move forward in a responsible fashion. So I feel cautiously optimistic. There is a sense of urgency around the world about mm-hmm. making sure that a powerful tool is used responsibly.
Finally, Professor, let me just ask you, this is the first time two women have ever won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. What does that mean to you?
I'm overwhelmed. I'm proud of my gender. I think, I guess I just hope that it says to girls and women around the world that, they should definitely feel free to pursue their passions and that their work can be recognized, as we're seeing in this example today.
Well, it is an honor to have you on the show today. Jennifer Doudna, one of the two winners of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, also a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you very much and congratulations again.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
There's a food that almost all of us can agree on, and that's the taco. America has had a love affair with tacos since the 20th century, when Mexican immigrants brought various forms of the dish to the States. And one of the few places that offers a vast variety of the taco is Los Angeles.
We have a term called the taco life. And the taco life summarizes LA's philosophy towards experiencing the city and its vast communities, inspired by the dish that unifies everybody in the city, which is the taco. Because no matter where you're from and no matter how much the city changes, the one constant will always be tacos. And most importantly, the desire to know where to find the best ones.
Javier Cabral lives and breathes tacos. He's the editor-in-chief of LA Taco and the associate producer of Taco Chronicles on Netflix. Yes, you can find a good taco anywhere, but Cabral says there's nothing quite like an LA taco.
Oh man, well, I'm such a staunch Angelino. I mean, I'm always going to be the biggest champion of LA food, and I'm probably going to tell you, you know what? I'm sure your place is cool, but there's a place in the San Gabriel Valley that is pretty cool too.
Cabral began his journey as a taco expert when he was a teenager and landed a one-of-a-kind opportunity as the scout of LA's cherished Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic, the late Jonathan Gold.
I would read the local alternative weekly to find out where my local punk shows were at, because I'm like a punk rocker dude who loves to go out to go see live music. And then one time while skimming through the pages, I started reading Jonathan Gold, and I realized that, like, oh man, Jonathan Gold is like, he's this dude who's, he's like getting paid to eat. Like, and in the back of my head, and in the back of my extremely teenage head, I was like, man, if this guy can get paid to eat, why can't I? and I sent him an email, just like a cold email, just like from like this 16-year-old kid. And then, he took me under his wing. He put in good words with me with, different editors. And, he kind of really showed me that it is possible to be able to do, like, what I dreamed of.
As the head of LA Taco, Cabral also hires young food writers of color. It's part of a larger movement to diversify food media, which is dominated by white critics and writers.
I was a teenager. I didn't realize that, like, food writing was a very privileged first world profession. I didn't, especially as like a punk kid. I just knew I loved food. So I think about that now because, it was actually brought to my attention this last week because, LA Taco allows me the ultimate privilege of investing in raw talent. I recruit new voices, and mostly POC voices. But again, I think I'm like a big testament to the fact that, if you just hire a POC person in a position like this, like, you will see results, because that's just like my world. That's my community. And these are people that I grew up with. It's not like I'm not actively trying to do it. I just do it because that's who I am. And at the end of the day, that's what it takes, is hiring, your community.
Cabral says who has the opportunity to write about food is important. And we couldn't get through a conversation without talking about some of the concrete examples of how immigrants have shaped the culture of LA through food. I mentioned that I'm new to Los Angeles. How do we begin to understand LA food?
Let's see. I would say first and foremost, start at Gelaguetza restaurant in Koreatown, because this is, for many reasons, and full disclosure, I did write the family cookbook. Um, So Galaguetza is a restaurant that has been around for 25 years. It was a favorite of Jonathan Gold. And it's emblematic of LA food culture because it is a Oaxacan restaurant that is doing mostly indigenous Mexican recipes in a former Korean barbecue building. And you can see that when you're driving by. And the former Korean owner didn't speak English, and the owner of Galaguetza, he didn't speak English either. And somehow they still communicated and like made a deal happen. And like now you and 2 decades later, it's like this iconic establishment.
Yeah. Do you think LA is unique, or is it really representative of what's happening across the country? I'm thinking about this because still to this day, my favorite Chinese food restaurant is in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And it's because there is a rich tapestry of Chinese people who decided to take root there. And so we see this all over the country, food reflecting back to us our changing communities.
That's so true. That's so true. And we're seeing just much more representation in restaurants because there's been a big reckoning in food media recently in this year, you know, with, you know, this a lot of the whiteness in food media being exposed at a national level. So, you know, this trickled down to like the big food cities, you know, such as LA, such as New York, such as San Francisco, because, again, you're going to start to see more POC writers and editors and reporters and media people just, you know, go out there and document these things.
What's your favorite taco in LA?
Oh, man, that's tough. that's like asking, like, you know, who's my favorite kid or what's my favorite band or what's my favorite song.
I was just going to say, who's your favorite child?
I don't know. I will say that the one taco that haunts me is the taco de camarón at Mariscos Jalisco. This is a fried shrimp taquito that is... it's really unique. The story is also really unique. It's a style of taco that was, it has roots in Mexico, in Los Altos de Jalisco, but it was perfected in Boyle Heights, California, in Boyle Heights, Los Angeles, California. It's a crispy taco that is topped with a cabbage-inflected oregano-scented tomato salsa with a buttery slice of avocado on top. So it's crispy, it's crunchy, it's juicy, it's spicy, and it's refreshing at the same time. It's like a ceviche taco.
Is it right to say that tacos are emblematic of LA? In that idea, has it become an American food? And what does American food even mean as I say it and relay it back to you?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I always like to keep in the back of my mind is that, you know, Los Angeles was a part of Mexico a long time ago, but it was. And you see remnants of that, you know, when you're driving by street names. So that being said, you know, I think we're living through a very interesting generation right now in LA because we're starting to see like the sons and daughters of Mexican immigrants or of Central American immigrants. And with this kind of advancement comes, you know, this morphing of like Mexican tacos and now Mexican American tacos.
Unfortunately, we're in the midst of this pandemic that really prevents us from fully experiencing what you're showing and telling us here. And I say showing because I can visually imagine, I can just see myself there experiencing all of these wonderful things that you're talking about. How is the LA food scene right now in the midst of COVID-19? And have you had a chance to hear from restaurateurs and, you know, some of the food vendors about how they're faring at this time?
Yeah, of course. So it's, you know, this is a concerning topic because, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, it's hard for restaurants right now. It doesn't matter any way you slice it. And it doesn't matter if you have a fast casual concept or if you have like a more fine dining concept, it's just hard for restaurants overall. You know, you've got to remember that LA was built on the kind of car culture, right? So a lot of these restaurants, they've been able to adapt and offer really nice takeout options. And I mean, even before COVID, a lot of Angelenos ate their meals in their cars, in the driver's seat, or, you know, in the hood of their car or in the trunk. So COVID, you know, what it did is it just made a lot more chefs, taqueros, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what kind of food you cook, it just made it more portable.
You know, you touched on this, but how are the street vendors doing right now?
Well, we have to remember, when talking about street vendors, they have operated by offering food at really affordable prices and offering usually wholesome food to their local communities. But this year was supposed to be a monumental year for street vendors because 2020 was the first year where it was legalized. This was a huge step because, you know, when you come to LA, chances are you're going to have a memory with either buying like chopped fruit from a corner somewhere with lime and salt and chile, or chances are you might have bought like a bacon wrapped hot dog after a night out to sober you up. But at the end of the day, those stands and those food operations have been, at least according to the city, illegal. So, I don't know. I'm confident that, you know, street vendors are resilient and they're going to continue to, you know, find ways of thriving even in COVID conditions. And I just hope that the city honors them and honors their hard work instead of punishing them.
That's Javier Cabral. He's editor-in-chief of LA Taco and associate producer of Taco Chronicles on Netflix. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. And if you ever need a recommendation, just let me know.
And this conversation is part of our series, We Are What We Eat, examining how our American food ways are changing because of COVID-19 and this country's racial reckoning.
It's been a little more than a year since federal immigration authorities restarted a policy known as medical deferred action. Medical deferrals allow severely ill people who don't have legal status in the United States and who can't access proper treatment in their home countries to stay here temporarily while receiving medical care. But as WBUR's Shannon Dooling reports, attorneys are worried that the humanitarian requests are once again under attack.
The Trump administration's efforts last year to quietly phase out medical deferrals created a national uproar. Congressional hearings were called, and a month later, when federal immigration authorities agreed to reopen the submissions, immigration attorneys like Boston-based Annalise Arujo were cautiously optimistic. But a year later, that optimism has faded.
We have no knowledge as to why these cases are being denied, and the secrecy is the problem.
Arujo says she's never had a request for medical deferred action denied by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, the agency processing these requests. That is, until now. And it's a case, she says, based on past experiences, had all the merits for an approval.
If they are being more strict, if they have a standard that they are following, then they should disclose this to attorneys. They should specify the reasons for their denials.
Arujo's clients, a mother and father from Brazil, overstayed their visas. Their 5-year-old son, who is a U.S. citizen, receives specialized treatment for severe autism spectrum disorder. It's care, they say, would not be available to them in their home country. Since their medical deferred action was denied, they now fear potential deportation. And they're not alone.
Hi, I'm Serena. I'm 15 years old. I was born without the pulmonary artery, which is in the heart.
Serena Badia and her mom agreed to meet outside in a park nearby their Boston area home. We're all wearing masks, and Serena is bundled up in a fluffy white fleece jacket with the Boston Children's Hospital logo.
I have an artificial artery, and the hospital has to check if it's too big or too small while I'm growing.
If it's too small, she says, she'll need open heart surgery to replace it. Badia was born in Spain and stood before reporters and politicians last year in Washington, D.C., asking for medical deferred action to be reinstated. Her request was eventually approved, but she's once again facing down another deadline. Her medical deferred action expires the end of November, and she and her mom worry it may not be renewed.
It's scarier than having a surgery, because if I go back to Spain, I won't be able to return to have a follow-up of my treatment.
Massachusetts Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey, along with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, requested information from USCIS in April. The data shows a steady decline in approved medical deferred action requests over 3 fiscal years. USCIS field offices reported granting close to 45% of requests in 2018, compared to only 11% as of May 2020.
You combine that with what we're hearing from around the country with the string of denials, it's clear that something within the program has changed.
Anthony Marino is director of Immigration Legal Services at Boston's Rehan Immigrant Center. He says they've received a handful of approvals for medical deferred action requests in the last year. But there are also cases filed in 2018 still waiting for decisions.
This is kind of what we feared. From the time that they claimed to be reinstating the program, we've always been skeptical.
That skepticism is shared by other immigration attorneys as well. New York-based Legal Health has been filing medical deferred action requests for more than a decade. Norma Tinubu is a supervising attorney there. She says not only are seriously ill clients receiving denials, the federal government is actively trying to remove some of them from the country.
We've never had a situation like we do now where we have five clients who've been sent notices to appear for what essentially is deportation proceedings. So this is kind of unprecedented for us.
Tinubu says those clients risk waiting in a crowded immigration courtroom during a pandemic while suffering from chronic or terminal illness. In Philadelphia, immigration attorney Audrey Allen says since medical deferrals were reopened a year ago, most of her clients have been denied. She says even two clients who had been approved in previous years had their renewals denied.
So clearly, when the facts have not changed at all and the decision is the opposite, something larger is at play, unfortunately, than just adjudicating the cases on the facts.
In an emailed statement, USCIS spokesperson Dan Hetledge said because there is no official application form for medical deferred action, the agency does not have approval and denial statistics readily available. He said decisions are made on a case-by-case basis. USCIS is facing a lawsuit in Boston's federal court. Advocates hope the case will provide more clarity around medical deferred action. Clarity that, up to now, attorneys say the federal government has not offered. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.